Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with The Modern Man. And thank you, everybody, for your overwhelming feedback about Ollie Peart's billboard in Slough. Sadly, I don't think any of you actually saw it in person, but those of you who checked it out online at facebook.com/Ollie Mann were stunned by its magnitude, clearly, because you've flooded us with feedback. Tom tweeted at The Modern Man to say, for some reason, I'd imagine the billboard to be about the size of a bus stop one, but it was mahoosive. Glenn tweeted simply, Ollie, this brought joy to my afternoon. Nozzy said, this is truly wonderful. And Stephen said, that billboard, opposite Europe's largest Tesco, is exactly the location of my old school. Could I ever have imagined a glorious scene like that? Who could, Stephen? Who could? Not the people of Slough, that's for sure. I don't know why this particular challenge has resonated so much with you all, but I'm glad it did. If you have a suggestion of a future challenge for Ollie Peart to try out, please do suggest it via the feedback page on our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk. We're always open to ideas. Remember, it's supposed to be about testing Ollie with trends, but obviously I do personally enjoy it if there's a touch of humiliation or physical danger involved as well. Right, on to this week's show. Hopefully you will have noted the intriguing title, the meaning of which will become clearer as the middle feature progresses. But like many of my interviews, I don't really want to reveal too much about what's in it in this intro, because it's all about lived experience. It's one lady sharing her story and you sort of taking the journey with her. So the only thing I will say up front is it might make you think twice before you ever chastise someone again for putting their feet up in a train carriage. Before we get going, though, big thanks to our sponsor this week, Harry's. They make super shaving products, but don't take my word for it, because Alex Fox has sent me the following email. I've never been a come-as-you-are girl when it comes to my pubes. I see styling them as an extension of my own famously bold personal expression, and my current trademark is trimming my private privet into a fox's head shape. Christ. So, me and my bits were chuffed to bits to give Harry's razors a try. I always buy razors aimed at men over those marketed to women out of principle, because blades for blokes aren't hit by the so-called pink tax, a markup that sees ladies paying more for everyday basics than men do for equivalent products. Their blades did a sterling job on my legs and armpits and were absolutely brilliant for a neat, smooth, quim trim. Harry's shaving gel smelled of manliness in a good way. It made my pubes smell of dudes. The distinctive writing style of Alex Fox, ladies and gentlemen. So, why don't you get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for $3.95. You can support our podcast and get your trial set delivered to you, including a razor handle, five-blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/man right now. That's harrys.com/MANN. And thanks again to them. And Harry's, I apologize for plugging your product in such a flagrantly vulgar fashion. But, you know, I mean, if you get into podcast sponsorship, it's par for the course, frankly. We're not fucking Classic FM. Right. On this week's show, you will learn why you need to clean your rims. It's a bike thing. You'll learn what I learned from the Ottolenghi Salad Cookbook. And you'll learn what deserting is and why it may help you on your next date. Let's go. On this week's Modern Man.
To be honest, I couldn't imagine a different way of life. All I could imagine was fixing it.
How does it feel when you don't feel welcome in our vertical culture?
It is also possible to have a tantric quickie.
And Alex Fox breaks the Tinder trance to discover urban tantra. But first, all the trends you need to know about for the week ahead. It's the zeitgeist with a man who I've just seen unable to finish a salad. It's Ollie Peart.
The size of that salad
it was huge.
Ridiculous. It was massive.
It was a big salad.
I'm only little.
What are your trends for this week?
Micro brands. Mm-hmm. We thought that the massive brands would be taken over by other massive brands that would take over their business.
Apple.
Perhaps. But instead, what seems to be happening is that the brands of the past are fighting against thousands upon thousands of micro brands that have a direct-to-consumer strategy. So what they're doing is they are marketing through social media channels. Uh-huh. They might only produce one or two products, but really, really well. And they have very few employees.
Isn't it just another way of saying artisan, bespoke, small, basically, manufacturer? We've always had those. I mean, are you a brand just because you'd use the internet now to sell in small volume?
But they're turning over tens of millions of dollars. They're making a lot of money because their marketing strategy is highly efficient. So it's reaching loads of people.
Is this basically Instagram?
Yeah. So like when you scroll through your Instagram feed, and you've definitely seen this even if you don't use it that much, you'll see a post and underneath the image will be like a bold colored bar. The text will say learn more or shop now. And the image will just be like somebody wearing some really nice jeans, staring over a view, holding a cup of tea. And you're like, oh, this looks nice. I'm going to click the button, learn more.
What am I buying? The tea or the view?
Probably the jeans.
Right.
But who knows? But the point is that they're super slickly designed products, all of them. So the imagery, and this is why Instagram is a fantastic place for these people to engage with their audience, just looks so super slick and super well designed, basically. It's all about the design. It's all about the aesthetic. And the thing is that these brands are largely people you've never heard of
before.
Okay,
give us examples.
AliveCore, this is a tech brand, and they design and sell an electronic ECG kit.
That's not an Instagram audience, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, that's what's weird about it. You look
it's
at
like
their
octogenarians
posts.
Want that, isn't it?
But it's super slick. It's about monitoring your health, and that's something that millennials love to do.
My favourite YouTube news blooper of 2017, it's fresh in my mind because I was watching this last night at midnight on my iPad when I couldn't sleep, was an Australian newscaster who couldn't say Fitbit and kept saying Fitbitch. It was amazing. So she said, like, there's been a craze for Fitbitch. There's been a craze for Fitbitch. I've done it again. There's been a craze for Fitbitch. And she just kept doing it. Brilliant. And give us one other then.
Distilled, but spelt. Of course, it's spelled like this. DSTLD.
Oh, no.
DTSLD.
And do they just sell water or do they sell, like, a filter?
Clothes. It's a fashion brand.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but they've actually been going since 2014.
But the point is, can you launch one of these mini brands just through organic reach? Or do you have to have a big marketing budget in the first place to be able to create the kind of posts on Instagram that are going to go viral to make your product a success? In other words, actually, were they always kind of mini companies to begin with rather than bedroom operations?
Well, the key, I think, is behind your imagery on Instagram, because with Instagram, you can use your hashtags to reach a huge targeted audience. Mm. And if the imagery is right, then people will love it. You don't need a huge amount of money to do that. You just need a mobile phone and a bit of a brain behind you.
Right. At this point, I'd normally ask you for a second trend of the week, but you've come equipped with Tupperware today.
Yeah.
Which leads me to think that our exploration into recipe boxes, which you were commissioned to do by Manfan Alfie in Chicago, might take some time. So let's get straight on with it.
Okay.
How many recipe boxes have you tested for us?
5.
And which ones are they?
HelloFresh, Gusto, Mindful Chef, Born and Bred,
yeah,
and Baked In.
So HelloFresh is the most kind of generic general one, right?
HelloFresh, Gusto's very similar.
Do they have a USP at all? Like we use all organic food or anything, or just no?
No.
Just general recipe boxes?
General recipe boxes.
Yeah.
So therefore, you know, professional couples that can't be asked to go shopping.
I wish that was the tagline.
It should be.
HelloFresh, for professional couples that can't be asked to go shopping.
Born and bred, based in Yorkshire.
All from farms in Yorkshire?
Yeah, like locally sourced produce,
yeah.
All that kind of stuff. So quality ingredients.
And then what was the other one you said?
Baked In.
Right. Is that just like cookies and muffins?
It is just cookies and muffins. So it's slightly different. But yeah. I thought, I'm going to go a bit off-piste here.
Are you any good at baking?
I don't think you can be shit at baking. You either bake or you don't. Do you know what I mean?
No. I mean, I don't because I think I would be shit.
It's just like it's flour, eggs, sugar. You mix it all up and you stick it in an oven.
Yeah. It's kind of maths, though, isn't it? That's basically why I don't bake.
What? No, it isn't. Why is it maths?
Because it involves recipe cards in general are things that don't appeal to me because my style of cooking, and I know this is going to sound like I'm a terrible cook, but I'm actually all right.
Mm-hmm.
My style of cooking is I will open the fridge, mm-hmm. see what I've got. Mm-hmm. I've put no planning into it at all. And I'll think, yeah, that'll go with that, that and that. And I'll put these spices on it. It'll taste fine. And it does. I'm not excellent. Nothing I make is 5 stars, but everything's a solid 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Recipes, like in a book or on a card in any form, I start making them and I somehow fuck them up and get angry at myself.
Yeah, interesting you say that actually, because even with the baked in thing, I still messed it up. even though I just said that anybody can bake. And that's all pre-measured, and I still got it wrong. I think you've hit the nail on the head with the way that I think most people cook that way. They just open their cupboard and go, oh, what can I throw together? Chuck that in there. Oh, yeah. It tastes all right.
I'm an idiot savant.
Yeah, and you end up making twice as much as you need.
Yes.
It tastes like sort of salty slop, so it's fine.
Yes.
Yeah? Yeah, okay, great.
You nailed my style.
And if you want to follow a recipe from a recipe book, you have to get the book out, figure out you're going to stand that up without getting all the crap over it. Then you have to get the stuff out, and then you have to work out exactly what 150 grams worth of carrots looks like, and then you have to slice all that up, and it's really annoying and it's irritating. And I thought this was going to be a bit like that. But I speak for all of these when I say the concept of having all of the ingredients pre-measured and pre-weighed out and organised into little packets, even though I hate the fact that there's shitloads of plastic, and then following these instructions is incredible. This is essentially flat pack furniture for food.
Okay, that's good to hear, because I sometimes, you know, if I'm watching Nigella or something, I sometimes, you know, when she'll just say, and put in a bit of this, and she'll put
a bit of this, yeah. Push in a bit of this, and a little bit of that.
And she puts her, like, dirty fingers that she's just been smearing all over her face or whatever.
I don't know how you know they're dirty, but yeah.
Into, like, a glass bowl of coriander or something, but it's exactly the right amount of chopped coriander. And yep. I always watch it, and I think, well, yeah, if I was you, I could cook that easily, but I've... Off camera, someone else has just chopped that exact amount of coriander and put it into a glass bowl. So is it like being Nigella Lawson?
It's like being Nigella Lawson, because you've got it eliminates that stress, and that's all gone. And the other thing, and again, goes for all of them, that I noticed immediately is there's no food waste.
Oh, that
is
good.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And I didn't think about it when it first arrived, but the portions are the perfect size, so you've got portion control. So if you were looking to lose weight or go on a diet, it's probably quite a good thing to do.
So you were trying out recipes for two people, were you? For yourself and your other half?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you are a vegetarian. How easy was that in the drop-down box decision process?
I'm actually a pescatarian, so that made life a little bit easier. But the vegetarian options are really good. So on the first night, we had a HelloFresh dish, which was Vietnamese-style rice. And do you remember my little...
Rice?
Yeah.
I don't send off for a box to learn how to cook rice.
Well, that's what I thought when I got this.
Fucking Uncle Ben's for a pound, you get ready-made rice.
Completely agree with you.
Yeah.
I was exactly the same. And
couldn't
even
be any more convenient.
Well, I selected some stuff and then their recipes changed and then they sent me this one. And I was a bit like, hang on a minute, I'm not sure I'd pay $34.99 for...
Is that how much it is for one recipe?
No, that's for three. That's for three, for two people, so six meals, $34.99.
Right, equivalent to 34 packets of Uncle Ben's.
Exactly, yeah. But, so yeah. I thought, well, I'll plough on, I'll go for it. The recipe card itself and the explanation is just really, really easy. So you can see on the back here, it's
okay,
got
he's
images.
Passing the recipe card, yeah. Oh, you that's nice.
Images
yeah.
that talks you through it.
Does show you in very simple terms.
And when it arrives in each separate bag. So my brief foray into veganism involved me basically eating horrible food that I didn't like and feeling a little bit ill. That's a vegan meal. And frankly, it was... delicious.
Was it really?
Really, really good.
Delicious.
I have one criticism.
Yeah.
It was slightly salty, and I've got some little notes on here. And my other half said, Pip said, she goes, one of the tastiest vegan meals I've had, I don't feel like I'm missing out. Quite the accolade from someone who slags me off all the time.
Right. But you thought it was too salty.
But it was really nice.
Okay.
And you didn't feel like you'd missed out, even though it was essentially Uncle Ben's.
What about Gusto?
So, with Gusto, we had 10 min Thai prawn fried rice with greens.
Okay, because just the name suggests to me a bit more gastronomic and therefore creamy. I was immediately thinking, I bet everything's a bit creamy.
No. It's essentially the same as before, but with prawns. So you feel like you're getting a bit more for your money.
So both of them are stir fries, though, really?
Yes.
It's not difficult to cook a stir fry, is it?
Well, this said it takes 10 minutes. It says it's a 10-minute meal. Guessing the idea, you know, again, professional couple, can't be asked to cook, get home.
Yeah.
And again... it was delicious.
Can you choose different levels of complexity, though? These are all the entry-level ones that you've done.
I haven't chosen entry-level for all of them, but yes, you can choose different complexity.
You can say, I want one that takes 40 minutes.
Well, you could, yes. So with HelloFresh, you can choose to have a quick box or just a normal box. A normal box, some of the meals will take like 40 minutes, 45 minutes. With the quick box, they take all of them are less than 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the simple ones for Gusto. This is a 10-minute meal. Again, with all of them, you'll get to a point you think, that's not right. I'm used to just chucking this shit in. Also, that's not enough of that. I'd put more of that in. No, follow the card. Don't deviate from the card. Do not deviate. What you are paying for, the reason they're so expensive, you are paying for a professional chef who has figured it all out. It's just you're assembling it. That's why I said it's like flat.
I'm actually
furniture.
A bit jealous of you for doing this task because I'd quite like to eat delicious things.
Yeah. Just one more thing on the Gusto. Also, ever so slightly too salty.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Nice. Delicious, actually. slightly too salty. Don't know.
See,
what
they've
doing.
Obviously, well, you say that a chef has worked it all out, but maybe a chef's worked out the British public like salty things.
Well, yeah, rich, salty things in a restaurant. That's what you go there for, isn't it?
Okay, so that's Gusto and HelloFresh. Good experiences so far. You mentioned the baking one briefly. You said you did screw it up. Was that their fault?
The instruction that I got wrong, and actually broadcast live on Twitter for anybody that saw it, was melting the white chocolate. And it said, whilst the biscuits are cooling, prepare the filling. In a small bowl, cover the white chocolate bag, bag five, with boiling water and leave to melt for 5 minutes. Now I'm thinking, all right, cut open the bag, pour the chocolate in, pour boiling water straight over the chocolate. No, because all you got then is watery chocolate. You're supposed to melt it in the bag. Moron. So I fashioned my own little ganache based on sort of multiple episodes of Bake Off that I'd seen.
But is there a picture of someone melting the chocolate properly that you just disregarded or not?
I would say that the picture is very limited in its description. Look, there it is, look, see?
Fine. I mean, yes, maybe you are a moron, but it's designed for morons, isn't it?
Mm.
So maybe they failed there.
And for you, Ollie Mann, because it's one of the few meals that I could actually bring with me. I have a sample here. Would you like to try some?
Yes, we've just been out for big salad. We haven't had pudding.
Now, make sure you get one with ganache, because I didn't make enough ganache. He's eating.
Okay, so it's squishy and it's moist. So it's like a brownie with a filling, basically.
Yes.
And it's ever so slightly burned, but not necessarily in a bad way. Just in a, it feels, if I'm being critical, like it's probably been in the oven a few minutes too long. But that gives it a homemade feel, which isn't a bad thing in a homemade baked good, I feel.
Do you like the ganache?
I like the ganache.
I might supply baked in with my recipe then. chocolate and butter, if you're wondering.
Right, yeah. How was the Yorkshire one?
Ah, okay, so the Yorkshire one. Oh, let's just lean down here. So I had baked hake on a julienne of cucumber and courgette with chantenay, carrots and new potatoes.
Oh, that sounds more like it. Better than rice.
Looks very sophisticated.
It does, yeah.
Very sophisticated indeed.
Although a julienne of cucumber turns out to be some chopped cucumber. I could have done that without getting a recipe box.
I kind of felt a little bit like that. So when I got it, I was like, well, you know, that's just courgette and cucumber. What are you doing that I'm not? Am I being cheated? Mm. It arrives, by the way, all the meat and the fish and stuff like that, it all comes in a bag with wool. And then it's got ice blocks in the bag.
Oh, right. Okay.
So I think it can stay out for like 24 hours, something like that, and it's probably okay. So if it gets left on your doorstep, it's kind of okay.
Bit wasteful though as well, isn't it, of the wool, really?
You can recycle it, so then it goes back. So if you're on a subscription,
okay. They
pick it up with the next one. And then,
okay.
Yeah. So with this one, and they also supply, which I really liked, the foil and the baking paper that was required to cook this one, because it was
en
papillote.
That really is for idiots, isn't it?
I liked it. So really easy to follow instructions again. Meal tasted very good, very fresh, very healthy. This one, I hate to say this because the guy was so lovely on the phone.
Not salty enough?
Yeah.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. But do you know what?
Like, I think you've just got a weird like salt imbalance.
No. I think
you have an iron deficiency and you're just blaming it on the food.
Possibly. And also, the quality of the ingredients was brilliant.
Noticeably better than the others?
Yeah. Yeah, it was, especially with the veg.
Okay, so there's one other one you haven't talked about.
So Mindful Chef are all about healthy eating and, well, here we go. This thing that I cooked, which was a spinach falafel with zingy kale salad, I actually cooked them for the weekend and the salad, and I took it for a picnic by the beach.
And?
Delicious.
Yes?
Absolutely. And loved it.
I've never made falafel, actually, so that is something that I'd feel like I'd done something good.
So easy. I'll tell you the other thing.
But would you now make it without the recipe card?
Yeah.
Now you know how to make it.
Well, that's it. Like, and a lot of them.
Yeah.
So you learn little tips as you're cooking. You think, I didn't know I could do that.
Yeah, I could get that from Tesco.
Did you know, for example, I mean, obviously you can, but did you know it was any good eating kale raw? Oh, I'm just going to go out for a bag of kale. You pulled it down and get. You wouldn't, would you?
No.
No.
I'm just trying to think if I've ever had it in a salad, but it's always like ever so slightly wilted, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Delicious.
Is it?
Oh, it's sublime. It's so good. Genuinely, it's so good.
Raw kale.
I will now look at raw kale in the supermarket and be like, I'm having that.
You know something I learned from the Ottolenghi salad cookbook?
Oh, yeah, go on.
Raw asparagus.
Oh.
In a summer salad. Delicious. Has to be very thinly chopped, obviously.
Gonna say, yeah.
Very good.
Also in season, I would imagine.
Yes, probably now is the time to go and make your raw asparagus salad. Why not?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's all five then. So, I mean, luckily we are not Which Magazine. But if you had to now, impartially, objectively, journalistically, rigorously assess, which is the best?
Gusto.
Gusto?
Yeah.
Why?
Affordability.
Yeah.
They are the best price, and the quality of the food is still very, very good, and it's really easy to follow. And I can prove it to you, because I've got a meal here that I've cooked from the box for you to try.
Oh, look at that.
quite a lot of it as he's well, because that's for two people.
That is a proper Tupperware full of stuff.
This is Chinese-style tofu and red pepper chow mein.
I'm actually staying at my mum's tonight. Can I take this?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
I haven't got a fork. I'm just going to use my fingers.
You go for it. I mean...
These are noodles, cold noodles.
Yeah, I know.
It's all right.
Is that it?
Yeah. Well, no, let me try the tofu.
Oh, yeah, try the tofu, because that's like the main deal.
Yeah, that's nice.
See, that's odd, because most people don't like tofu.
I don't like tofu, but that is nice.
Yeah, see?
Close your eyes and it could be shit chicken. well done on completing your challenge, Ollie. Let's see what we've got in the digital envelope for next week's challenge.
I'm excited.
Ollie Pitt, here's the digital envelope. What does it say?
Thank you very much. It says, from Charlie, who says, I'd like Ollie to try his hand at a spoken word night. This is partly because they're growing in popularity in the country, but also because I run one in Brixton.
Do you know much about spoken word, Ollie? Ironically silent on this.
Yeah. It's like those Nationwide ads, yeah?
Yeah, slightly, yeah. Underwhelming cabaret. Yeah, it's a bit like that.
It's basically
that. It's like sometimes it's poetry, I think. Sometimes it's people talking about their lives. Sometimes it's like a stand-up comedy who's not like really funny, but is a bit sort of bits of pathos, bit of real life.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's people reading embarrassing things out of their diary. Anyway, you're going to find out more because we checked with Charlie, and it just so happens, Ollie, that there is a spoken word event tonight. You have 3.5 hours to prepare.
I've got a...
For your first gig at a spoken word event. Yes, you're on the bill tonight in Brixton.
How long have I got to be on stage?
I'd feel cheated in the audience if I didn't get at least 10 minutes, wouldn't you?
10 minutes?
I'm just saying.
I'm not doing 10 minutes. You spring at me like that. I've got to go from here.
Yeah.
Okay.
How are you getting to Brixton? You're staying with your sister. Where's that? Mitcham.
Yeah. And then probably just drive there.
Yeah.
And
so the whole way, whilst you're trying to find a parking space.
I'll just describe it. Describe it. That's all it is.
Great.
I'd just be like,
be a brilliant spoken
word
event. That. Man describes a trip to Brixton.
Worried about my car outside. Might get nicked.
Yeah.
Hire car. Has he got a rhyme spoken word?
Well, I'm not sure that did.
No, it didn't. That's why I questioned it.
Yeah, beat poetry. Yeah, why not? Do whatever. I don't know, Ollie. You're going to find out. That's the format.
I'm quite nervous.
Have a great time.
Thank you.
And we'll find out how you got on next week.
Goodbye.
Hello, Man fans. I'm Jenny Gwizdowski, the director of the London Bike Kitchen. We're a DIY bike workshop, and these are my life hacks on how to keep your bike happy. Tip number one, pump your tires up. Keeping your tires pumped will help prevent punctures, they'll protect your rims, and make for a more comfortable ride. You want to keep them pumped up to their recommended tire pressure. This is written on the sidewall of your tire, and it'll say something like 80 psi or 4 bar. Both of these are correct, they just come from different measurement systems. And while you're at it, invest in a track pump with a gauge so you know exactly how much you're pumping up to, and do this once a month. Tip number two, clean your chain. Please, for the love of God, clean your chain. Use a dedicated bike chain cleaner or even just rubbing alcohol. I wouldn't use washing up liquid because there's a lot of controversy online as to whether or not this is actually okay for your chain at all. One way you could do this is use two old toothbrushes, face the heads towards each other like they're kissing, and tie a rubber band around the bottom, and you can use the brush bit to clean the top and the bottom of the chain links. And if you want to, sneak your bike into the shower. Just don't tell anyone. I won't tell anyone. Tip number three, last but not least, clean your rims. All that dirt and gunk from the road builds up on your rims, and every time you brake, that crap is grinding itself in, wearing the rim down faster. So just grab an old t-shirt and wipe them down once a month with some warm water. And while you're down there, make sure your brake pads still have some life left in them by checking if their grooves, they kind of have these teeth grooves in them, are still visible. If they're flat, then you need to change them ASAP. If you want to learn more about your bike, visit lbk.org.uk. If you like bikes and podcasts, I'm one half of the Wheel Suckers podcast, and you can check out my new book, How to Build a Bike.
Now, before I met today's guest, Raquel Messager, I felt obliged to ask whether she would rather talk to me sitting down or standing up or lying down. I was also sure to ask whether the 40 minutes that I'd put aside for our interview was too long for her. I wanted to check if she'd already done some stretches that morning before we started talking. Now, this is not my usual interview checklist, but movement and stillness is important to Raquel. Ever since she was a kid, there was only one thing she always wanted to do.
As far as I remember, I've just always danced. Where we lived in London, there was a hotel across the road that used to have a New Year's Eve party every year. And I just remember being on the dance floor all the time and my parents having to like drag me off the dance floor. I just loved moving. It's the way the world makes sense to me. It doesn't really make sense to me when I can't move.
And so how much thought did you give it, becoming a professional dancer?
That was actually total accident. I danced when I was younger and I did kind of ballet and tap and modern, as you tend to do if you're a young girl. When I was 12, I think I discovered boys and the discipline of the dance classes kind of fell away. And at Bristol University, I started dancing again. And then when I dropped out of my history degree, because it really, really didn't suit me, I was dancing with some local dancers and we were sort of doing semi-professional kind of performances. And then one of them moved to London and she got in touch and said, this school, London Contemporary, is becoming a conservatoire. You don't have to pay fees anymore, because before that it was £9,000 a year to study dance. So I was lucky enough to get a place at London Contemporary and to do a three-year degree in contemporary dance, which was amazing. I started a co-founded dance company called Lost Dog while I was there, which is still going strong, doing really well. We opened a show in February. The biggest stage I ever danced on was Hanover Opera. Yeah. And that stage was incredible. I mean, it was huge, those vast opera sets. So behind the stage, you've got like this, a whole other stage where they store the sets. It's vast. And when we were on the stage warming up, waiting to do the show, we were behind this very thick fire safety curtain. And then when the curtain went up and people were still talking before the lights went down, it was like a cacophony. It was so loud. There were so many people in that opera house. I was quite shocked. But that was probably one of the highlights, yeah, of being a dancer.
I mean, did you ever imagine not dancing?
No. I felt blessed, like I'd like won a very rare golden ticket to be able to go to study it in the first place, and then to get to actually be paid to do it was incredible. I never thought it would happen. But once I had started dancing, I hoped that that would be my future for at least the next 10 years.
And then one day you started feeling pain.
I started feeling a twinge in my back in particular lifts. So in a fireman's lift, which is quite a common move in contact improvisation, you might be lifted on someone's shoulder while your chest is falling down their back, that kind of a lift. Suddenly, every time I did that, I was in pain, quite sharp pain, and had to come out of it quite quickly. And I was finding it more and more difficult to take weight.
And when that happened, it was in a rehearsal studio, was it?
Yeah, a rehearsal process during the day. It was part of a warm-up.
I mean, I know everything that I know about dancing from, you know, Black Swan and A Chorus Line, basically. But from what I understand, even with a chronic pain for a short time, dancers will continue dancing through the pain.
I mean, the whole discipline and the whole way you work your body, you are pushing on the edge of pain the whole time. What you put your body through every day it's painful. The twinges started getting worse and it started getting to the point, at that point I was working on a show and it got to the point where lying down, generally contemporary dance warm-up, the first thing you'll do as a company in the morning is all lie down together. Uh-huh. And then someone will lead a warm-up. Just lying down on the floor, the very first thing, I would normally be in so much pain that I'd be crying and just trying to hide that I was crying.
Yeah.
And then, as you do in companies, rightly or wrongly, what my colleagues would do is kind of mask me for the warm-up. So give me time and space. So one very good friend of mine that I was working with at the time would generally dance around me so that to anybody else it would look like we were duetting, but actually he was doing most of the moving and I was conserving myself for the rest of the rehearsal day. It would be awful in the mornings and I'd think there's no way I can dance today, and then I'd slowly warm up, which is, I think, is quite a common pattern for people, and then I'd be okay. I'd kind of manage the day. But it definitely wasn't right, and it definitely wasn't right to be crying all the way through a warm up. I was quite desperate at that point, and somebody recommended a chiropractor that treated footballers, that was quite famous for treating footballers. And they knew them personally. So on a recommendation, I got an appointment with him. And he was an incredibly arrogant practitioner and did a huge maneuver on me. And 24 hours later, I had the symptoms, which are now recognized as chronic neuropathic pain, burning, shooting pains in my feet and legs. It was a day after that manipulation that I was in a rehearsal with a friend, and we were trying to create this duet in this living room, and I just couldn't shake these pins and needles in my feet. I kept kind of shaking it, stretching it. I couldn't shake, and then it started burning. I just couldn't shake it. Didn't really understand what it was. So I called my osteopath that evening, and he just said, "Whoa, we've got to call time now. You've just got to stop. Those are different kind of symptoms to normal pain or aches. You have to get that checked out." And so I stopped dancing. I had to withdraw from the rehearsal process, go and get a scan. The scan confirmed that I had a slip disc.
Oh, wow.
And then it just felt like the whole thing just kind of...
You didn't know you had a slip disc?
No, but
a slip disc is a big deal.
Well, it is and it isn't, because from all the research that I've done since and all the specialists that I've spoken to, if you MRI'd half the people in the street that didn't have pain, a lot of them would have slip discs.
Is it only painful when it hits the nerve or something?
It's only painful in certain instances. They don't know why.
Okay.
Yeah. It seemed like this was trapping a nerve, and that's what was causing the sensations.
Okay, so at this time, obviously, you're disappointed you've had to pull out of this latest project.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're thinking there's a warning signal here, but I guess you are thinking, I can treat this and go back to work.
I've been told it will pass in 6 weeks. I've been told all you need to do is, like, you need to swim, you need to do these rehab exercises, you need to keep moving, but take a bit of a break. So I was told 6 weeks. 6 weeks became 3 months, became 6 months, became 12 months.
And in pain?
In pain, the whole time.
Hey, so yeah, and when you say words like chronic and the whole time, do you literally mean all the hours you're awake?
I literally mean all the hours I'm awake.
And it's a pins and needles, but more intense?
It's a pins and needles, but a kind of burning pins and needles. And I mean, I can quote a collaborator of ours, Dr. Chris Eccleston, because when he says that pain, it interrupts and it disrupts, that's what it's designed to do. So the symptoms in themselves are not huge. I wouldn't put them on 10 out of 10 on a scale, but they are constant. So they just wear you down. Mm. And during a day, it feels like it just becomes an overload of sensations on my whole nervous system, with the pain interrupting everything that I try to focus on, until I have to rest and reset the levels, and then I can focus again, or then I can have enough resources to be able to exist through the interruptions and the disruptions for another 2 hours, maybe an hour.
So a year into this,
I'm pretty desperate. If I zoomed out, I'm running all over London trying to figure out how to manage it, talking to different specialists. Some people have said had surgery, some people have said don't have surgery.
So how old are you at this point?
I'm 30.
And you're thinking about back surgery?
Yeah, very seriously.
I mean, my mum's just had back surgery and she's double that age.
Yeah.
And even at her age, people were saying, you know, you do realise there's a chance that this could be completely debilitating. You might have to spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
I was just thinking, I want my life back. You know, when I had to stop dancing, I lost my community, my practice, my income, my peer group, everything in one go. And I found myself incredibly isolated, which is what happens to a lot of people with chronic pain. To be honest, I couldn't imagine a different way of life. All I could imagine was fixing it and getting back to where I was, or picking up where I'd left off. I couldn't imagine doing anything different.
In your heart, did you think there must be a chance I'm not going to dance again with this? Or were you just completely blinded by the fact that dancing was your life and you were going to dance again?
I think I was completely blinded by Western medicine, thinking that and that classic model of find it, fix it, that we have, and the way we think of the body as a bit of a machine. Mm. To me, the only way it made sense to me was, I have these symptoms, there must be something mechanical going on. The disc must be pressing on the nerve, even though a couple of specialists looked at it and said, well, it's inconclusive whether it is actually touching the nerve or not. Even then, I couldn't understand why it was happening if there wasn't a cause. So even though I was terrified of the surgery, I thought, what is the alternative? Mm. So a year, I think 18 months after it started, I had surgery. And I woke up and there was no change in symptoms.
You knew that the moment you woke up?
I woke up and there was no change in symptoms and I panicked. They said, you know, don't worry, it can take a few weeks for the symptoms to resolve, but they never resolved. So
from the moment you came out of surgery, you said you had that same pins and needles feeling?
Yeah, the same. Yeah.
Oh, that must have been devastating. I mean, all the physios coming in and saying, we're going to make you better, and you thinking, no, you won't.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking. I was bereft. I was lost. I was like, okay, if this doesn't work, what do I do now? You know, what on earth do I do? And the advice at the time that I was given from the people that were treating me was, you need to stay mobile for as long as you can. So they'd already put me on certain medication. So the advice was to continue on that medication, what I now know is a really high dose of that medication. It's like the maximum dose, and keep dancing. And so I tried to, but I didn't feel creative anymore. I spent my whole time in the rehearsal process trying to manage the symptoms and worrying about were they getting worse or not. And what I understand about pain models now is that constant focusing on the pain, has it gone or not, can in itself set up a pain loop that then the body can't turn off. So all that panicked time at the beginning where I was just constantly checking to see, has it gone yet? Has it gone yet? Can I get back to work yet? Has it gone yet? That in itself may have set up a system, a loop that I'm now trapped in. The symptoms were just getting worse. So I decided to stop performing. And at that point, I was completely lost. If I'd been lost before, after the surgery, when I didn't know how I was going to live with these symptoms, without having the kind of goal or the structure of I want to get back to work, I really didn't know what to do. I tried all sorts of things. I went traveling, I joined various organizations, did loads of meditation. I tried several other careers. I trained as an English teacher and thought I wanted to kind of join the NGO kind of circuit and worked in Thailand and Burma for a little bit. But none of it kind of stuck. I've tried to kind of move sideways into several other, like teaching assistant or several other professions. And I don't know, I just wasn't very good at them, I don't think.
But is it partly because pain management sort of goes hand in hand with fatigue, that actually it's just hard to get the energy?
Yeah, it's hard to get the energy and it's hard to work in a context that you can't control. So like a 9-to-5 is impossible for me. For me to go to an office for a 9-to-5 is not possible.
And that's what your situation has really brought to your attention, isn't it? Is that other people who don't work with the kind of institutions that you do, artistic ones, who, you know, perhaps aren't fulfilling all the obligations they should, but have a well-meaning tendency to support people, people who do have 9-to-5s with chronic pain, just are at the moment a kind of ignored disabled population.
Either suffering in silence or getting quite from all the responses I've had recently, from getting a lot of stick from co-workers about needing to lie down or do some exercises or stretches. Yeah, people choose different ways to manage chronic pain. I've heard from some people who they pace very exactly. And one person who responded to the survey that we did said that they can work for 3.5 hours a day. That's what they can do. And then the rest of the time they're at home resting. And that's what they've chosen. I want other things in my life. So I'm not prepared to do 3.5 hours for somebody else in an office and then have nothing outside of that. I did that for a while when I was doing teaching assisting, and then when I got home I would just be flat for the rest of the evening and I had very little social life. I had no art or culture or anything like that in my life at that time. It was very, very bare, stripped down. But people make different choices.
And one of the biggest challenges you found is trying to find places in public to lie down. Talk me through that.
So often people don't go out because they're worried that there will be nowhere for them to rest. And at one point I just decided that I wanted to be in the world. So I was going to need to find a way. And I did manage to turn it into a game for myself, as in what, you know, trying to find the best places to lie down while I'm out and about in the world, trying to map that.
What do you mean turn it into a game? What would the alternative be?
The alternative would be to apologise for lying down in public, to not lie down in public, or to try and find places to hide where I could do it, where people wouldn't find me. So I've gotten quite bold about saying I have a condition I need to lie down, do you mind? Or else just doing it.
What kind of places are you talking about?
I mean, if I'm out and about in the world and I'm probably going to a meeting, I'll make sure it's in a cafe where they have benches, or more often make sure it's near an arts venue where I know there is a reading room, or somewhere, a sofa, a particular alcove where I know I can lie down.
And you need to be completely horizontal?
For me to really rest, I need to be completely horizontal in semi-supine, which is when you're lying on the floor and you've got your knees bent.
Knees bent.
Feet on the floor.
So basically like childbirth position, but without your legs spread out, basically.
Kind of, yeah.
So that's, I mean, the reason I say that is it's obtrusive, isn't it? It's not even as subtle as lying down flat.
As lying down flat.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, lying down flat is painful.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I do, yes, I'm careful to not wear skirts and lie down. And
but how do the public respond? You're lying down in a cafe. I'm in a cafe having a cappuccino. Yeah. You're on the table next to me lying down in that position with your legs sticking up.
So generally, if that happens, I'm probably with someone. Mm-hmm. So, and we allow very different things of couples or groups of people. It has happened that I've been lying down with my partner in a restaurant, in a very, very quiet restaurant, and we're, say, waiting to go on somewhere else, and I know I need a little lie down before we head off. And staff have come over and said, it's not appropriate, please don't lie down. And I've explained, and then they've sort of suggested somewhere else where I might lie down.
Yeah.
That's happened.
And how does that feel? Because on the one hand, they're actually trying to be considerate. Mm. On the other hand, what they are saying is, you are embarrassing us.
Yeah. It always feels shameful.
Yeah.
If I'm honest, it always feels like you're being told off and you're doing something you shouldn't do. The words that seem to work best is I have a condition, or I have an invisible disability. Even though that might not be the language that I choose to describe myself as, those are the ones that people understand. As soon as you say disability, people behave differently.
Why? Because of compassion, or because they're worried about lawsuits?
I think because of political correctness. You can't really argue with someone when they're saying they're disabled.
No one wants
they
to say that anti-disabled people. Yeah.
Even though the social model of disability talks about, like, well, you're only disabled if you're in environments where your needs haven't been considered. So actually it's the built environment that disables me, not my condition. But that's too complicated to explain to someone in that moment when you just need them to be open.
Yeah. Imagine saying to the bloke in Byron, let me talk to you about the social model of
disability. Yeah, exactly. Just give me 3 minutes of your time and I'll change the way you see the world.
Yeah.
So that's what I generally tend to say, that I have an invisible disability and I need to lie down. And is that okay?
It's interesting what you say about people will allow groups to do things differently to individuals. That's true. When you're by yourself.
When I'm by myself.
And someone tuts. Or says, why are you lying down?
Yeah, when I'm by myself, I generally don't lie down by myself in a cafe. I'll lie down by myself in an arts venue or in a theatre. I feel much safer doing that. I wouldn't do it in a cafe. Sometimes libraries, sometimes churches. The place that I get the most stick is on trains, because there seems to be something about me lying down on a train, taking up more than one seat, that really, really knocks people. And people have been...
I feel so sorry for the people that tut at you, though, because then when you do say, oh, I've got an invisible disability, they think that they're doing the right thing, don't they? They think they're representing the little guy.
I think we generally like to police other people in our public spaces.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a kind of right on political correctness English thing.
It's an English thing, yeah.
Maybe. But people have been rude to me when I've been lying down in front of my partner's children, which is not a great model of how to be compassionate to other people.
But of course they have, because they just see a woman who looks healthy and in her 30s or early 40s now, lying down on three seats on a train.
Yeah, three seats sometimes, yeah.
And they just think, seats, what, brilliant. You're being oafish, basically.
Yeah, I think they see it as disrespectful.
Yeah.
And so generally people tut, say things like, this one happened quite recently. It was quite a busy train, and it was down from London to Brighton. We were opening a show in February, so we were doing later nights in the theatre. And I really had to lie down. I wasn't going to make it. But it was quite a busy train. And the mother and daughter came and sat opposite and said, oh, you know, take care of yourself. Take all three seats. Why don't you?
Yeah.
And the tricky thing is that when someone said something like that, when you come back and say, I have an invisible disability, this is why it really helps if I can lie down for a bit. This is why I'm doing it. They then get defensive, because then they feel like they've been in the wrong. Yes. So then she said something like, all right, you don't have to explain yourself. It's a really tricky thing to negotiate.
And of course you do have to explain yourself, because no one else is there to do it for you.
Yeah.
Exactly. There's no way, is there? You can't hold up a sign.
No, I mean, I've got this wristband now that says differently normal, and I've got a little key ring that explains that sometimes I need to lie down. It's got
have a look.
Yeah, it's a little laminated. It's really good. You can read out if you like.
Sometimes I lie down to manage a medical condition, and then it's got a picture of a stick lady lying down with her leg in the air like you described. It may be unconventional, but it means I can do things that I otherwise wouldn't be able to. If I lie down, don't worry. It is my normal. So you show that to someone.
What I've tried to do is when I'm lying down, I've tried to leave it somewhere where you could see it, but it hasn't, so far, I have to admit, it hasn't really worked. So far, people have still, conductors have still sort of, told me to sit up and basically told me to behave myself. And I have lots of stories. We've collected lots of stories about people being basically told to behave themselves by other people in public spaces. One awful story of a lady in the V&A, going to the V&A, she'd just come out of a really bad chronic pain flare-up, asked if she could lie down for a rest, and then some older people who were also at the V&A came and sat right by her so that they were touching, one was touching her head pretty much, and the other older man stood so close to her that if she turned her head, her face would have been in his crutch. So they did that for about 5 minutes until she felt so uncomfortable that she sat up, and then they left. They didn't need to sit down there. It wasn't that they wanted to sit there. They just saw a younger woman not behaving herself, I guess. I'm assuming.
On aeroplane travel, you can actually throw money at the problem, can't you, if you can afford it and get yourself a business class seat?
Yeah.
But there isn't actually even that option on a train. There is nowhere to where you can actually lie down unless you take up more than one seat.
Yeah.
The system has no solution for you.
No, we're a vertical culture. And I'm assuming because that means you can get more people on it and it's cheaper.
Yeah, but you can get a wheelchair on the train, but you can't lie down. I mean, I've never really thought about it before, but you can't.
No, you can't. Unless
so is
you
that a change you'd like to see then?
I would. I would like to see rest spaces where I could turn up in a city that I don't know and never be more than 20 minutes from a resting space. 20 minutes for somewhere where I am welcome to rest. And that's something that I'm trying to create with the Resting Spaces Network, which is a group of venues, theatres, cinemas, independent cinemas, galleries that are up for it, that are kind of part of the conversation at the moment. And we're talking about really simple, low-tech solutions for how you could invite an audience who have hidden conditions. Also, some of them are beautiful ideas that people have suggested that would be lovely things, not just for people with a condition. So it's been suggested that you have twilight viewings of an exhibition where everybody can lie down on the floor and the paintings are hung to be seen from that point, and you have like a candlelight kind of exhibition, which would just be a beautiful exhibition.
Yeah.
Whether you have a condition or not, it would be a different way to experience something.
Yeah.
We have a kind of, quite a few people have been in touch because galleries, we have this tradition now of galleries being very open spaces with no seats at all. Yeah, where you're just free to kind of walk around. And for a lot of people, that means that they can't go to the spaces, or they've tried to go and they've maybe sat on the floor to look at a painting and they've been told they're not allowed to sit on the floor. And one lady who said she went to see an exhibition and because she couldn't sit on the floor, she had to go back to the reception every 5 minutes or 10 minutes to go and rest there and then go and see another piece of art. And I'm amazed that she persevered because I don't think I would have.
I had a chat with an architect once about public spaces or quasi-public spaces on what were actually privately owned gardens outside a skyscraper or outside a development that he was building. And he'd said that he wanted to put more, I don't think he mentioned beds, but he wanted to put more chairs and benches for people.
Mm.
And the reason that he hadn't put them in the plans was because the council or the developer or the owner had said, that's going to encourage vagrants.
Mm.
Is that something you run into?
I think a lot of the time when people get nervous about me lying down, it's because I've taken off my shoes, I've made myself comfortable, and it might look like I'm bedding out. So yeah. I think that is definitely something I rub up against. Also, a lot of the spaces that we take to be public aren't public spaces. They're kind of corporately owned.
Yeah.
And like you say, they don't want to encourage people to spend more time there than necessary.
But it really highlights that, doesn't it?
Mm.
Like, I mean, actually, there's presumably nothing wrong with you lying down in Regent's Park, but in Canary Wharf, you're not supposed to. And that's not a very attractive quality of Canary Wharf.
No, exactly. I wouldn't. I think I'd stay clear of Canary Wharf. But I suppose theatres to me seem to be the kind of perfect place to create such a resting space, partly because they're places that are playing with different etiquette anyway, because they are, you know, they're creating theatre and experiences that are different and hopefully eye-opening and mind-expanding. But generally, they're busy during the nights and they're less busy during the days. During the day, often they're virtually empty. So why not co-opt them as spaces that people can use where they're not just welcome, that they've been considered, that they're told very clearly from the messages of the venue that you belong. Because I think that's what a lot of people with chronic pain, I just feel like there's lots of spaces where I feel like I don't belong and I'm not welcome.
And there's a euphemism that you've invented for lying down a lot.
Cloud spotter. So for me, that speaks very clearly of the horizontal needs and fatigue of somebody with chronic pain, which means that I need to lie down a lot. But also, I am a genuine cloud spotter. I do love cloud spotting. There is something about that that even helps reset pain levels. It's quite a meditative thing to do.
Yeah, it speaks to the fact that it doesn't have to all be grim. I mean, you're lying down to recover from pain. But looking up at the sky, taking a moment out of your day to do that is something that everyone could do and can be quite a beautiful thing to do.
Definitely. I mean, I'm quite careful. People have suggested to me quite a lot, oh, well, you know, rest in so that you're more productive. That is a, you know, we kind of understand that in our culture. And I'm really trying to ring fence it as rest being a good thing to do in and of itself, not so that it makes you more productive or more creative or more anything, just it's a good thing to do, full stop. You know, can we fathom, can we even contemplate that in our current culture, that stopping, resting is just good?
So you seem to have found some sort of mission, I guess, out of your circumstances.
Yeah.
But presumably you'd rather you weren't in these circumstances.
Absolutely. And it's tricky. I really want to resist that. I do feel like I have a core purpose now. I really want to resist the sense that I've come out of it. I've kind of waded through those dark years and now come out with some kind of mission.
Resist it? Why? Because it feels like a cliche.
It feels like a cliche, and it feels
like people doing heroic things.
Yeah, and it feels like disabled people are only allowed one of three narratives: disability is tragic, or disability gives you some kind of mission or sixth sense, or about how you should live life and some kind of epiphany or enlightenment. The other one is conquering disability. Of course, that's the one we really like.
Paralympics.
Yeah, three acts. Yeah. Exactly. You have, as you were before, you have the challenge, you overcome it, and you go on to do great things. And I really want to resist that, because for most disabled people, that is not a true narrative. And that's not a possible narrative. That's why I want to resist it, because it's not like I've come through something and now everything's peachy.
No, you're developing something. You're developing a network of spaces to help people actually just carry on with the mundanity of coping with disability.
Well, hopefully just to open their worlds a little bit.
Yeah.
Because those worlds shrink. I think what you lose a lot in disability or in illness is it's very hard to hold on to your dignity. And hopefully a network of resting spaces will help people feel considered and help them have dignity when they are trying to access art and the spaces where normal things happen. What I'm hoping is, for myself, say that there's one film in the independent cinemas season where I can lie down to watch a film, and then me and my boyfriend don't have to have a discussion about, is it too much to go to the cinema tonight? You know, in the week, is it, what am I doing that day? Too many meetings? No, won't be able to do it. When I can just go, I can definitely go to that, because I know no matter what I've done that day, I can lie down.
So they have a baby screening and they have a senior screening. They should have a cloud spotter screening.
Why not? I just read recently that they've just trialled at the Picture House in London, having screenings where you can come with your dog and they give you dog blankets and bowls for people who are so attached to their pets that they want to go out with them. If we can do that as a society, we can definitely make cloud spotting screenings. We should do at least that.
Raquel Messager. And you can express an interest in helping establish her proposed network of resting spaces at unchartedcollective.com. Still to come, our record of the week, and Alex Fox is up next after this. Time for a fumble, a rumble, and a tumble with Alex Fox. It's the Foxhole. How are you?
Hey there, Ollie. Hi. I am full of caffeine, but regrettably less full of peen, which is why this week I have...
You've been flicking the bean?
No, in fact...
Come on, that wasn't bad for an ad-lib.
That was excellent, Ollie, but I've actually given myself a whole new reason to have a sore finger by swiping left and right on the dating apps again.
Okay.
Now, I'm not a huge fan of dating apps.
Why?
I prefer to meet people in real life. I think you can just gauge more about a person face-to-face and get more of a sense about whether they are your cup of tea. And I've done lots of things to try and increase the amount that I meet people IRL, even down to ordering some little cards from Etsy that are like cute little, they kind of look like business cards, but they've got sweet slogans on, and carrying a pen with me at all times so that I can give my number to attractive people that I see on the tube and stuff like that.
And the idea of handwriting that down is because it looks more spontaneous than having a printed quasi-business card with the same function.
Yes, which looks creepy.
Okay, good.
There's a fine line between these things sometimes.
We're all learning.
So I am actively trying to meet people face-to-face in places other than the internet. But as a busy, busy person, I am more busy and buzzy than your average bumblebee hive. There are limited amounts of time I have to go out and try and fraternise with the general public. So I do find that sometimes going on dating apps is an efficient way of meeting lots of people who are single and ready to mingle.
Okay, so what is your preferred app of choice?
Well, I'm currently on Bumble.
Ah, now that's the one that supposedly women have more of a say in, right?
If you're matched with somebody, then the woman has to speak first. So
right.
If you change your mind for whatever reason, then you don't have to enter into that conversation. Of course, it doesn't stop people from sending spontaneous dick pics or being dicks.
But just by definition, presumably, if you're someone who would send a dick pic, you know, at the first opportunity, you probably wouldn't sign up to Bumble as a man.
No, it does tend to have a slightly higher calibre of gentleman.
More
on
of a
there.
Stealth weirdo.
Yeah. That's precisely the kind of person I'm
slowly.
Looking for. Stealth weirdo, marry me now. The thing that makes me feel like I'd rather be fapping instead of apping and just pleasing myself is that apps often to me feel like more of the same work and the same obligations that I already have a lot of in my business day. It's more essentially interviewing strangers about their lives, which is what I do for a living. It's more demands from my mobile phone and from my screen, which I feel inundated with already.
Yeah.
And you can probably hear it in my voice, Ollie. The whole idea of apps just makes me feel a bit angsty, a bit cynical, and a bit down. And I identified that because I was having these feelings before I'd even opened the damn thing, I wasn't bringing my best self. I had entered what I call the Tinder trance, where you're just swiping thoughtlessly. You know, you're moody, you're not expecting to meet anyone decent on there, so you're just pouring away at your screen, dismissing everybody without really being mindful. And I think you can miss people if you're just doing that. So I've been actively trying this week to try and practice some of what I preach. And to that end, Ollie, because I am me, I have invented some terms to help keep this the positive behaviour in my mind.
Excellent.
Do you want to learn these new words?
Yes, please.
Okay, the first one is being compassionate. This means exercising compassion when you're pushing buttons. Because I will fully admit that I now live with a guy who's dyslexic, and I've actually dated several people who are dyslexic and who were wildly creative thinkers and incredibly intelligent people. And that's made me more aware that a lot of apps encourage us to assess and judge people on their communication skills via text, which for some people, if they have dyslexia, for example, isn't their strong point, or they might just be in a rush or in a meeting or using public transport and desperately trying to plonk out a message whilst they're on the 96 at the same time.
Okay.
So I'm trying to be compassionate and remember that people will have other things in their lives that might mean that the messages they're sending aren't always the best of themselves.
And what other term have you got for us?
Deserting. When I desert a date at the end of the night, when I leave them, I am trying to plan something sweet waiting for me, so that however well or badly the date has gone, I know I have the power to cheer myself up. And this only has to be something small, like I've got a Spotify playlist of songs that really raise my energy levels and make me want to, you know, I can't fail to skip along the street like an idiot when they're playing. Or I might have bought myself a little bubble bath or bought myself something nice to eat when I get home or encouraged my friends to send me ridiculous memes or in-jokes. So I've got lots of things to cheer me up. And I've found that that is also a good thing to do, even if I've gone on a date that's gone really well, because it helps me feel less like my mood is completely dependent upon what somebody else has brought to the table.
Yeah, some great advice. One of the places, of course, where you can always buy something that will make you feel sweet and happy when you return home is mycondom.com.
Who put all of their products through extremely rigorous testing.
Do
all,
they?
Yep. CE quality marked, pinhole tested, dermatologically tested, individually electronically tested, tensile strength tested, airburst tested, water leakage tested.
Pinhole tested? They don't literally put a drawing pin through the end of a condom, do they?
No, thankfully not. It means that one by one, every condom is electronically tested to see whether it has any microscopic pinholes in it. Mm. They do it by popping it over a sort of metal phallic shape and then sending it through an electrical field that checks whether there are any abrasions or damages in the latex covering it.
Well, My Condom have sponsored our listener question for the week, and it's from Andy, who says, Alex, what is tantric sex? How do you do it, and what is it supposed to do? And do you have any suggestions for how I could get into it?
It's all about being conscious, being mindful about living in the present moment and really being aware of everything that's happening to you, if you're with a partner, with your partner, and being very, very, living very vividly in that moment. The second thing that Tantra says is that everybody has the right to experience ecstasy. It places great emphasis on ecstatic sensations and feelings. Now, this is very different from the feelings of adrenaline, that sort of short, sharp rush that you might get from a standard orgasm or that minute moment of elation in an otherwise sweaty, thrusty session. Tantra encourages people to embrace the ecstatic nature of an entire experience, make everything about sex from the beginning to the end and beyond all about reaching a higher state of consciousness and a higher bodily and spiritual sensation.
It's funny,
a very spiritual thing.
If you take away some of the philosophical language and concepts, actually it's not that different to what you've been telling us across numerous weeks, and actually what I know and lots of people know from personal experience, which is sex is better if it isn't focused on the orgasm at the end, basically.
That's
absolutely
true.
I mean, it's about paying attention all the way through, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. Tantra, though, perhaps places more emphasis on that, and it helps people reach that that consciousness via particular practices, one of which is being really hyper aware of your breathing. So this is in order to help people relax, to help focus on their mind and their body. You might hear people talking about chakras, or these are focal points or so-called energy centers in the body.
So is it anything to do with endurance? Because the one thing that everyone knows, or everyone thinks they know, about the sting thing was that what he was essentially saying when he said it to a magazine journalist 20 years ago that he did tantric sex was, me and Trudy Styler, we have sex all night long. That was sort of the implication of it. Does it last longer?
Tantra can help men and women and people of all genders to last longer in bed, yes. It does this via a variety of ways. For a start, it encourages people not to see sexual sensations and climaxes as originating solely from their genitals, but to appreciate sensation in their whole body. So men might start to experience orgasmic feelings in places other than their penis. They might experience whole body orgasms, or they might be able to shift their awareness of where they're feeling pleasure all around their bodies.
Very much takes two to Tantra then, doesn't it?
No, not necessarily.
Really?
Yeah.
I can't be focusing on my breathing whilst my wife isn't aware that that's what's going on.
Oh, I see what you mean. I was going to say you can practice Tantra on your own.
Oh, sure, yeah.
One of the two big myths, though, what I see is two main myths about Tantra. The first is that it always has to last a long time. Now, while it can help you enjoy great, long, enormous, extended sex sessions should you wish, it is also possible to have a tantric quickie once you've established the mental processes that get you in that frame of mind. Mm-hmm. And secondly, Tantra doesn't have to be practiced between two people. It can be practiced amongst many, or you can practice it on your own.
But if you want to have tantric sex, then you need to both be doing it, don't you? It can't be just something you're practicing whilst the other person is unaware that that's what you're doing.
You could bring in some elements of tantric practice into the way that you are making love to somebody without them being aware of it, but it is designed for everybody involved in sex to be on the same plane, to feel that connectedness.
I mean, so the clue basically is if your partner suddenly starts writing Fields of Gold during sex, you know that's what they've been thinking about.
Now, a word of warning, because tantra intersects with spirituality, some of its teachings in some of the strata of tantra, if you will, do come from certain gurus. In fact, one in particular is called Osho, also known as Bhagwan Rajneesh, who, if anyone is watching Wild Wild Country, the story of the sex cults on Netflix,
it is from him.
I would like to emphasize that there's lots of great teachings in tantra, but you are completely allowed to take what works for you, and you do not have to buy in hook, line and sinker to the whole shebang in order to improve your banging. So with that in mind, I'd like to recommend a brilliant book by a woman called Barbara Karelis. I'm actually re-listening to the audio version now, and it's a fairly old book, but it's been updated. It's called Urban Tantra. It gives you an overview of tantra. It gives you some really entertaining stories about it. It's very easy to get into.
And some practical techniques.
And lots of practical techniques. And most importantly,
it's quite conceptual, isn't it? It can be quite hard to actually just start doing it, I imagine.
Well, this is tantra without a lot of the wiki-wiki-woo-wah hipster hippie bullshit that puts a lot of people off. You can do the candles and the ostrich feathers and the batik wall hangings and whatnot if you want to, but those things are not necessary for tantra, and neither is a lot of the hippie guru crap that goes with it a lot of the time. There's some really interesting things discussed in the book, actually. Barbara chats about how people who are asexual, who we've talked about before, folks who don't have any desire to be sexual with another person, can still benefit from tantra because it places emphasis on the whole body. She also talks about how men are often told to think of something gross and off-putting in order to stop themselves from ejaculating. And, you know,
told or develop that skill by themselves.
Well, Barbara argues that the opposite is true. That if you're really aware of what's happening and you've managed to hone your ability to live in the moment, that can actually be even more effective at prolonging your ability to put off an ejaculation while still allowing you...
How would that work?
Well, it's about being aware of when you're coming up to ejaculation and maybe shifting that energy elsewhere in your body, focusing on another point of pleasure. If you're someone who is in a relationship and want to give this a try tonight, then Rebecca Lowry, who is a teacher from selfalchemy.com, tells me that one of the simplest, easiest ways to get into tantra is just to learn to be present, to notice your breathing, focusing your breath in and focusing on your breath out just for a minute or two. Now that sounds so dismissively simple, doesn't it? But how many of us really do that before we start making love? How many of us really spend a couple of moments being in our bodies that way and just breathing together?
I think very often it's because the switch gets flicked, isn't it? Like, you know, the routine of sexual contact is something that you find yourself going through the motions with. Like, you're something, oh, we're doing this now. There's not, you know, as you so often say, there hasn't been a thoughtful discussion beforehand. You know, suddenly it's happening. And so a lot of these things don't, you know, you're just in it, aren't you? And at that point, it's a bit weird to say, let's stop. Let's take a breather. Let's sit and focus on our breathing. Let's think about spirituality. I mean, that's a bit weird.
Well, this is why, for many people, a big part of tantra is ritual. And the word ritual scares a lot of people. They think they're going to have to chop the head off a crow and nail it to the ceiling. But by ritual, what a lot of tantric practitioners mean is a little routine that you do with your partner or by yourself in order to get your head in the right place before you start doing things with your body. I spoke to another woman called Amanda Gaylove, and she suggested an exercise that you can do on your own or with a partner, which is called kiss your genitals. It does not require you to actually do that because you need to be a lot more significantly flexible than I am. This involves sitting together or on your billio and just slowing your breath to a conscious pace, breathing in and out a little bit more fully and deeply every time. So every time you take an in-breath, just try and make it go a little bit deeper in your body. I mean, some people find it useful to count. So count. So in, one, two, three, out, one, two, three. And try and breathe right down to your genitals. Some people aim their breath at the perineum, so that space in between the anus and whatever genitals you happen to have at the front, that central point of sensuality as they see it. And she says, don't put any pressure on yourself, don't force yourself, don't rush yourself, just let your breath go deeper all the way down and imagine that your breath is gently giving a kiss to the inside of your genitals each time you fill your lungs, and allow that whole kind of charge to flow over. You might want to clench your pelvic floor and see how that feels, but yeah, a lot of it is about breathing.
There you go. I'm not told a lot that I talk out of my ass. I didn't realize I could breathe out of it too. If you have a question of sex for next week's show, what do you need to do with it?
Hop, skip and jump on over to the Modern Man website and click feedback.
And when you finish breathing through your perineum and you want to wear some protection in that area, you can buy that from mycondom.com.
And if you use the code FOXHOLE, FOXHOLE, then you can get 15% off everything on the site.
Well, that is nearly it for this week's Modern Man, but there is just time to appoint a new ambassador. It's Tim in Whitechapel who sent us £15 via PayPal. Thank you, Tim. paypal.me/modernman. He says, Ollie, I've lost count of the amount of times I've laughed aloud on the tube or walking down the street to your show, particularly as I am a huge fan of shit puns to the Foxhole section. You are now a weekly tradition for me. Do you have room for a disco-loving ambassador based in Whitechapel? Apparently we do, Tim. Congratulations. And talking of music, our theme is by Django Django. They're currently on a US tour. Catch them if you can. And here is our record of the week. It's by Toronto-based band Bernice. It's called Glue, and it's available to stream now. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
South to walk and sit to sing and sleep in bags and pillows, tie your dreams down.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.